Okay, we are back for episode 130. We agreed tonight to talk about the Club of Rome. The Club of Rome was founded in 1968 at the Accademia dei Licenzia in Rome, Italy. I guess hence that's the name, Club of Rome. The Club of Rome consists of current and former heads of state, UN bureaucrats, high-level politicians, government officials, diplomats, scientists, economists, business leaders from around the globe. Some might say the usual suspects, I guess. The Club of Rome was founded by Aurelio Pecci, an Italian industrialist, and Alexander King, a Scottish scientist. It was formed in a small international group of people from the fields of academia, civil society, diplomacy, and industry, met at the Villa Farnesina in Rome. The club's membership consists of current and former heads of state, UN bureaucrats, politicians, you know, like I said. The central to the formation of the club was Pecci's concept of the problematic, or problematique, as he might say. It was his opinion that viewing the problems of mankind, environmental deterioration, poverty, endemic ill health, urban blight, criminality, individually or in isolation as problems capable of being solved in their own terms was doomed to failure. All are interrelated. It is this generalized meta-problem or meta-system of problems which we have called and shall continue to call the problematic that inheres in our situation. The Club of Rome stimulated considerable public attention in 1972 with its first report, The Limits to Growth. The club is a membership organization, has different membership categories. Full members engage in research activities, projects, and contribute to decision-making processes during the club's annual General Assembly. Of all the members, 12 are elected to form the Executive Committee, which set the general direction and the agenda. Of the Executive Committee, 2 are elected or as co-presidents and 2 as vice-presidents. The Secretary General is elected from the members of the Executive Committee. The Secretary General is responsible for day-to-day operation of the club from its headquarters in Winterthur, Switzerland. Aside from full members, there are associate members who participate in research and projects but have no vote in the General Assembly. The club has honorary members. Notary honorary members include Princess Beatrix of the Netherlands, Mikhail Gorbachev, and King Juan Carlos I of Spain. The club has national associations in 35 countries and territories. The mission of the national associations is to spread the ideas and visions of their respective countries, to offer solutions, and to lobby for a more sustainable and just economy in their nations, and to support the international secretariat of the club with organization of events such as the annual General Assembly. The central mission of the Club of Rome is to act as an international, non-official catalyst of change. The range is prompted by the slowness and inadequacy of governments and their institutions to respond to urgent problems, constrained as they are by structures and policies designed for earlier, simpler times and by relatively short electoral cycles. This, in the view of confrontational nature of much of the public and international life, the stifling influence of expanding bureaucracies, and the growing complexity of issues suggests that the voice of independent and concerned people having access to the corridors of power around the world should have a valuable contribution to make towards increasing understanding and at times jolting the system into action. The members of the executive committee are frequently consulted by decision makers in international institutions, governments, the business community, civil society. This has always been an important part of their work. Of course, I mentioned The Limits to Growth. The Club of Rome stimulated considerable public attention when it first published that report. That was, of course, that was 1972. Its computer simulations suggest that economic growth could not continue indefinitely because of resource depletion. This is, of course, in the context of the 1973 oil crisis, which increased public concerns about this problem. The report went on to sell 30 million copies in more than 30 languages, making it the best-selling environmental book in history. Even before The Limits to Growth was published, Edward Petzl and Mihailo Mesovic of Case Western Reserve University had begun to work on a far more elaborate model. The research had the full support of the club in its final publication. Mankind at the Turning Point was accepted as the official second report to the Club of Rome in 1974. In addition to providing more of a refined regional breakdown, Pestel and Mesovic had succeeded in integrating social as well as technical data. The second report revised the scenario of the original limits to growth and gave a more optimistic prognosis for the future of the environment, noting that many of the factors involved were within human control and therefore that environmental and economic catastrophe were preventable or avoidable. In 1991, the club published The First Global Revolution. In its analysis, the problems of humanity, calling these collectively or in essence the problematique, it notes that that historically social or political unity has commonly been motivated by enemies in common. Quote, the need for enemies seems to be a common historical factor. Some states have striven to overcome domestic failure and internal contradictions by blaming external enemies. The ploy of finding a scapegoat is as old as mankind itself. When things become too difficult at home, divert attention to adventures abroad. Bring the divided nation together to face an outside enemy, either a real one or else one invented for the purpose. With the disappearance of the traditional enemy, the temptation to use religious or ethnic minorities as scapegoats, especially those whose differences from the majority are disturbing. Every state has been so used to classifying its neighbors as friend or foe that the sudden absence of traditional adversaries has left governments and public opinion with a great void to fill. New enemies have to be identified, new strategies imagined, and new weapons devised. In searching for a common enemy against whom we can unite, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. In the totality and in their interactions, these phenomena do constitute a common threat which must be confronted by everyone together. But in designating these dangers as the enemy, we fall into the trap which we have already warned readers about, namely mistaking symptoms for causes. All these dangers are caused by human intervention in natural processes, and it's only through the changed attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself. In 2001, the Club of Rome established a think tank called TT30, consisting of about 30 men and women, ages 25 to 35. It aimed to identify and solve problems in the world from the perspective of youth. As of 2017, there have been 43 reports to the club. These are peer-reviewed studies commissioned by the executive committee or suggested by members or a group of members, or by outside individuals and institutions. The most recent is Come On Capitalism, Short-Termism, Population, and the Destruction of the Planet. In 2016, the club initiated a new youth project called Reclaim Economics. With the project that they support students, activists, intellectuals, artists, video makers, teachers, professors, and others to shift the teaching of economics away from the mathematical pseudoscience it has become. On March 14, 2019, the Club of Rome issued an official statement in support of Greta Thunberg and the school strikes for climate, urging governments across the world to respond to this call for action and cut global carbon emissions. So that's the brief history of the Club of Rome, its activism, at least what it sees itself as being or its mission. So the Club of Rome, is it just one of these benevolent globalist organizations funded by oligarchs to save humanity from itself? Or is there a hidden agenda or alternative motives to all this, all these policies or that it promotes? Joe?
What a shock, Tim, but there is actually. I know none of our listeners would have ever expected that, but now it's just to get it out of the way. I mean, the Club of Rome is a propaganda and, you know, sophistry-driven organization. The idea is just to make people feel bad about existing and be okay with depopulation. I mean, that's just on a broad stroke, right? What the thing is. And it's just, and so, you know, it has, you know, a club like this is kind of like the Freemasons in general. You know, they have like a secret inner core. Who knows what these guys are doing? And then outside in the outer circles, you've got, you know, naive individuals, good individuals, all sorts of different things. And so you can't really see inside the thing. So the Club of Rome is many things. You know, it's like an elephant to a blind man. It just depends where you grab onto it. I mean, I'm sure there are legitimate, you know, overpopulation issues. But if you actually look at the history of the criticism of the Club of Rome, you can see how important it is in a number of ways and how obvious it is as a secret society intent on genocide of the European, I would say, is a good expression as to how to characterize its main goal. Now, the Club of Rome is interesting in that this was really what the LaRouche scholar's first attack was, the Club of Rome. I didn't know this until this week. I was looking at stuff about the Club of Rome, and I was shocked kind of what I saw in terms of the criticism. And what happened was, is the Club of Rome came out with its crackpot sophistry. You know, in the early 80s, it was talking about we got to get population down. People are bad. And LaRouche was, he was upset because he had this sunshine economic theory. He was kind of LaRouche was sort of a would-be economist. And, you know, he was a crackpot. Let's be fair about it. But,
We did a show on Lyndon a while back, so.
Yeah. I mean, that's right. You know, and I mean, I love the guy, but, you know, he's kind of like full of himself. And so he didn't like the fact that the Club of Rome was attacking basically his theories of economics, because he was saying unlimited growth. Yeah. He was saying, no, there's no reason for depressions. There's no reason for recessions. You know, he says, we've got to like go for this unlimited growth. And he saw them as basically irrational. And so he began investigating him. And then his investigations into the Club of Rome took him, of all places, into the P2 Lodge, which we've talked about so often. And once LaRouche got into the P2 Lodge, all hell broke loose, because he could see that these weren't just stupid people. On the contrary, they were liars, you know, Pecky and Alexander King. He could see that this was actually a genocide agenda that was being flowered, you know, over with fancy words and expression and stuff. It became very clear to him that they're not serious, because he could see this through the relationship between Pecky. I don't know how to pronounce the guy's name. I call him Pecky. Pecky.
I think it's Pecky with Italian.
Like the little rat-faced psychopathic actor, you know, who's always in the, you know, Scorsese films, you know, that miserable individual. But anyway, so I'm just going to call him Pecky. So anyway, it could be wrong, but who cares? His name, I call him Pecky. He's one of the founders with King. They founded it, of all places, the villa you were talking about belonged to David Rockefeller.
The Bellagio, yeah.
Rockefeller actually listed the Club of Rome as one of his achievements in a kind of a brief bio he gave in some press conference. You know, he's talking about how instrumental he was. And, of course, Rockefeller had already been in play in terms of the depopulation theme. And so the Club of Rome with the depopulation concept, you know, was, you know, you could see the hand of the Rockefellers was there from the very beginning. But anyway, so LaRouche, when he took him on their kind of contradiction to his sunshine economic total expansion theory, he found out that, you know, that Pecky and King too, but Pecky specifically, could be really easily traced into this whole P2 mess, because it was through the banking relationships that were inside the P2 that Pecky's bank was part of, that LaRouche began to started to dig deeper and deeper. You know, it's kind of interesting that that Pecci was actually caught up in the P2 thing because, frankly, everyone in Italian governance was, and finance. I don't know if you've ever seen a list of what was actually inside the P2, but I'm just going to read it so people can get a sense. And we've already gone through this, but I think it's a good idea. It was like the head of the current prime minister's cabinet, the secretary to the president of Italy, the heads of the Italian joint chiefs of staff, 17 army generals, 6 admirals, 9 Cabernini generals, military police, the 4 Air Force generals, that's all of them, and another 200 of the top officers, the heads of all 3 branches of the Italian Secret Service. It goes on and on. Well, anyway, they also, the banking stuff was involved in this. And you had this thing called the Inter-Ally Bank. And it was basically, let's see, it was... it was an overarching banking organization. It was all over the world, but it was basically part of this P2 banking cohort. And Inter Alpha contained, of all things, in it banks that were, had Pecci under employment, and also all of these friends of his. This guy Gardner, who was he was an ambassador to Italy, but he was always involved in kind of mischievous stuff that, LaRouche was ferreting out. So you had LaRouche coming at the Club of Rome. And when he discovered all of these connections into basically a secret society, he developed a cohort of scholars, the LaRouche scholars, that include Chaikin, Steinberg, Tarpley, these guys. Mm-hmm. They started digging deeper, and they were able to, document all this stuff that basically the P2 agenda was really being manifested by the Club of Rome, because, P2 was working both sides of the street. It had, like, the communists and the fascist terrorists, fighting each other to create chaos. And,
yeah, they were a big part in Gladio.
Yes, Gladio, exactly.
60s to the 80s, this false flag terrorism.
Gladio, if you didn't have a secret society kind of in the back of all. And so then when LaRouche, went deeper, he could see that P2 is actually just, it wasn't some rogue Masonic organization. It came right from the original lodge that Manzini had set up. And it kind of disappeared during World War II, but it never really had completely gone out of existence. And then it just recreated itself. And then you ended up with the Red Brigades and all of this mischief that they were involved with. But you see, now LaRouche was into this broad conspiratorial organization that the Freemasons were involved with, I've mentioned that my opinion is like the alt media begins with Gary Webb when he posted the documents, on the internet.
Yes.
Okay.
The San Jose Mercury News series, 1996. Yeah,
that was kind of like really critical. Well, LaRouche is really critical because this was when you really started to have the criticism. The Club of Rome was the first component of a secret society that was hidden and was controlling basically history. I mean, like before this, when I look at critics and researchers before LaRouche, like in the 60s, you don't see any of this. So this is really kind of the beginning of an exposing of what I would call the secret society.
Yeah, a lot of these organizations they're treated or taken at face value by the public or by media. Yeah.
And so this was really the most important thing about the Club of Rome is that it led to basically, it was so absurd, its position, and of course it was directly in opposition to LaRouche's economic theory, that it provoked LaRouche to dig into it. And he could see after a while, because remember, he had really good scholars working with him, Tarpley and Jake, and and Steinberg too. I'll just tip my hat to these guys. Mm-hmm. These are great researchers. They got in there, and I just wanted to read one of, this was actually written in the 80s by LaRouche's wife. And so check this out. She said that this was directly because of the research that they were doing into who was in back of the Club of Rome. And what they saw was a lot of these people had been Nazis. They had been Italian Nazis. Now, remember, who the Nazis were.
Were they Nazis or fascists?
Well, fascists.
Okay.
Okay. But in any case, and Nazis too. They were both. I mean, they were Italian fascists, industrialists and stuff, but they were actually members of the Nazi party in Italy, a few of them that then popped up again in their research into who was in the Club of Rome and who was in the mm-hmm. P2 Lodge. And they started to see this, that these organizations like P2, Club of Rome, and then Freemasonry were actually all just a veil for a secret society. But I just wanted to read her comment, because I was shocked by this, because this is basically LaRouche's wife was writing about, how history has been it's not what we think it is. So she wrote, "Not only Germans were involved in bringing the Nazis to power, the cults and mystical superstitions that became the Nazi ideologies were those developed by the Thule Society, the Order of the Golden Dawn, the Theosophists, and other groups congregated under the umbrella of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. Hitler himself was brought into power on the assistance of Finance Minister Schacht, an asset of the Bank of England."
Hitler's finance minister Schacht was he grew up in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I know. Well, and he was in the first Freemason lodge that was let back into existence after the World War II, after the war ended.
And he was acquitted at Nuremberg. So
yeah, well, of course. I mean, none of these. But anyway, and so they then looked at this, and they looked at and could see that this Alpine Lodge of Freemasonry in Switzerland, which had all the bankers, right, was involved in this. Now, when she wrote that, they hadn't actually started to expose Zionism. Zionism came later, but the Club of Rome, because of its ham-handed genocidal program, which was too obvious, basically. It was too weakly reason. No one could take their overt cause seriously. Because you could see going back into Rockefellers, right? I mean, the LaRouche guys went into Rockefeller. They go, look, he's always, trying to reduce population. Well, anyway, I was just going to point out that these secret societies, the Club of Rome, is really kind of useful as far as, the schematic. We talk about building it out, the schematic. The Club of Rome is very interesting because when you look at its DNA, I mean, what is really motivating it, you can see that all of these societies, the secret societies, the Freemasons, the Bohemian Grove, the Skull and Bones, B'nai B'rith, Club of Rome, that they pop up with different names and different people, but they have this kind of DNA that runs through them. And the reason I would characterize it as this: they're always in favor of two things. This is the DNA. They're always in favor of depopulating Europeans. They have different ways of doing it, but they're always in favor of it. And Zionism. And I realized, I go, all of these people, they're a couple thousand people that you can actually identify as Club of Rome, Skull and Bones, so all of the high-level Masons, Bohemian Grove. I was thinking, I was going, I can't think of a single one who isn't a Zionist or is neutral in position, but I can't think of anyone who's criticized Zionism, and I can't think of anyone who is opposed to basically massive birth control under every possible, just all the abortions you want, just get these populations. So I did a little test, Tim, I actually said, well, is there anyone that, you know, and I thought, well, Skull and Bones, there was William F. Buckley, who was a famous Catholic, you know, famous Catholic. But of course, he was a huge Zionist, right? But I thought, well, maybe, you know, I didn't know what his position was on birth control. I had no idea. I just thought, well, maybe here would be an exception. And I wouldn't really end the principle because, you know, they can easily have someone who has like a false, you know, position to try to just create some legitimacy and believability. I mean, there are people that, you know, are like inside the deal that will sometimes come out and like criticize Israel, you know, for, you know, some aspect, but then when it gets right down to it, you know, there's no real criticism of Zion. Anyway, so I looked into Buckley's position on abortion and I thought, well, if there's ever going to be someone inside Skull and Bones who would be, you know, opposed to abortion, it'd be Buckley, because he's this famous Catholic guy. But you know what I found is fascinating? He was actually one of the precursors to making it not a sin. And he had this very complicated argument that he used to attack the people who were trying to promote abortion. He basically said that history has already moved past this point and the church loses moral authority when it tries to enforce something which can't, you know, be enforced, that no one takes seriously. He wrote that the church has much to ponder. He's talking about, you know, abortion and birth control. When after pronouncing a practice anathema, the flock ceases even to wince. A sense of the sinfulness of the act is hugely important to the moral order. In its absence, there is a terrible void. So there you have it. I would say the Club of Rome exhibits the DNA, you know, what I call the DNA, which is just no matter where they pop up, these two things, and no matter where, how disparate the overt position that they're taking, you know, they're like the Green Society, you know, the people who run the Green Society in Germany who come out of, many of them come out of the Club of Rome, couldn't find anybody that would like take a position in opposition to Zionism, you know, even though during this period the Palestinians are getting genocided, you know, and they're so concerned about mankind, but I just don't see any concern for the Palestinians. So somehow this moral equation never enters into the big picture as far as these guys are concerned. But they will always be there when it's time for population reduction. So this is my, you know, sorry to be long-winded, but that's just my take on the Club of Rome, is that it's interesting. It's an exhibit. It exhibits the, you know, the classical DNA of the secret society. It's just as evil as a rattlesnake. I mean, people should just study it from the perspective of learning how we're being attacked.
Yeah, depopulation is a big thing. That's one thing you can always look for. Look to see in some sort of prescription or policy proposal or what they have to do. You got to cut the population. You got to impose either indirectly or indirectly sterilization or contraception. There's just simply too many of those people on the planet. I think it was in 1980. Howard Odom, a marine biologist at the University of Florida who was a member of the Club of Rome, was quoted as saying, "It is necessary that the U.S. cut its population by 2/3 within the next 50 years." He did not elaborate on how that was to be accomplished. 2/3. 2/3. That's about 200 million people. Wow. And of course, this was in 1980 under the during the Carter administration. A task force was created to expand the limits of growth document. Produced a Global 2000 report, a two-volume report, authored by former Secretary of State Cyrus Vance. The report, which was presented to the president, attempted to project the global economic trends for the next two decades. And indicate that there aren't enough resources on the earth to support the expected dramatic increase in the world population. The document says that the population of the United States should be reduced by 100 million by the year 2050. That's an official government document. About a half year later, the Council on Environmental Quality made recommendations based on the document titled Global Future, A Time to Act. They proposed an aggressive plan to control the population, which included contraception, abortion, and sterilization. So they weren't fooling around here. Another thing you can always look for is whatever problem they say is out there, whatever problem that needs to be addressed, the solution is always world government.
Right, exactly.
We need to act together. This is the thing. World governments. And, of course, a lot of problems with that, because how does one hold such a government accountable? How does it represent people? All types of... These are the problems. You know, they look at constitutional governments, national boundaries, borders, constitutions, procedures, you know, checks and balances,
And ethnicity.
Ethnic bound. All these things are obstacles to their plan. You know, and so today you see it being promoted in terms of like global homo and they'll use things like trade, environmental crisis, and these things to knock down these barriers to their business model. That's what you look for in these things. And what it is, I'm just reading through this. This is just technocracy, and this is the reason why technocracy was this crackpot idea that was developed in the 1930s during the depths of the Great Depression. At Columbia University, I think it was Howard Scott and King Hubbard came up to it. Howard Scott was another crackpot who ended up being a fraud. Was kicked out, claimed he had all these degrees, and found out he didn't have anything, and they kicked him off the campus. But nevertheless, they came up with this idea. You know, economies didn't work anymore. Politics was dysfunctional. You couldn't have representative government, so you needed basically a rule of experts and scientists. This idea was then picked up again by the Club of Rome. Rockefeller, I think, thought that this would be picked up now. And it's interesting that they started being promoted. And this was led to Brzezinski and the Trilateral Commission and these things. But, that report, Limits to Growth, is published in 72, 73. And this coincides with the Arab oil embargo and the supposed energy crisis. And they say how the crisis of that, the 73 oil crisis made people aware of this problem, but that the entire crisis was completely fabricated. It wasn't necessary. And even the embargo itself, the price controls and shortages were pretty much fabricated. They were created to create a pretext to raise the price of oil and address other issues. It was the Bilderberg meeting in 1972, where they called for a crisis that would justify the quadrupling of oil prices. This would turn a bunch of overseas operations profitable overnight. If you quadruple the price, the North Sea oil production, the Alaska pipeline, and these things, all these productions. So they wanted the price of oil to go up. And it was Kissinger who was able to foment this war between Israel and the Arab states in 73. And the price went up four times, 400%, just like they wanted. And this is also the era of the petrodollar, which had during this time had been created in the wake of the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. But so with all oil being denominated, most oil of the world sales being done in U.S. dollars, the quadrupling of the price of oil in dollars would enrich New York banks like Chase Manhattan, because that's where the money was going to be deposited even when the Arabs sold the oil. It also created a vast pool of credit for the U.S. government, because that a lot of the dollars were being bought up in treasuries. It was 1974 that Kissinger penned the National Security Study Memorandum 200, which called for the immiseration or depopulation of the Third World to take pressure off resources. And this was going to be done through, one thing is forcing contraception, making aid dependent on those governments enforcing and actually imposing forced sterilization and contraception, but also the energy crisis itself would throw a lot of the developing world into debt, and debt would then be instrumentalized or weaponized against these countries. So this usurious banking system that we now grown under was greatly strengthened in this period of crisis. Of course, it turns out the crisis, the energy crisis, even much of what they identified as the environmental crisis was all fabricated, you know?
Yeah. So these things have been weaponized, and the Club of Rome was just one of these organizations that, had been created just for this purpose. One thing that I was kind of fascinated by when I looked into David Rockefeller is that he actually had an organization that was kind of a precursor to the Club of Rome. It was sort of his own thing. It was inside the Rockefeller Foundation, but it had almost exactly the same sort of mission statement. And they had a guy who was kind of like the chief, you know, theoretician of the thing. And his name was, I think it was Harold Weaver. And he wrote a memo, the Weaver memo. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but this was actually, you have to remember the Rockefellers are, you know, had funded Margaret Sanger, you know, so they had been in the population reduction business from the very beginning. But Rockefeller's organization had this guy Weaver, and he wrote a memo. And in it, he talked about they need to develop a pill. He said, a pill. This is kind of like the very first time I think anyone ever had actually talked about this. Very old. It's like the 30s or something. Anyway, he wrote that he says birth control. This is his own. This is actually his position here. He says birth control will chiefly involve the application of known procedures where they are culturally acceptable, the development of improved, cheaper, simpler, more effective procedures, and this is my favorite, the reorientation of cultural and religious ideas to permit effective use of present or future procedures for birth control.
How is that going to be accomplished?
Well, gee, I guess you just described it. I mean, you need world government. So, you know, world government is, it's one of the things that the Club of Rome will need in order to implement all of its, you know, its theories. It will reduce the population of everyone except for the chosen people, which, you know, whoever this groups are, they don't have to worry about anything. Everyone else will be on the chopping block. We just sit here and take it because they have been able to get into these positions of power, and the secret society uses secrecy and lifetime actors, you know, people like Pecci and Alexander King, who will get up there and make these statements of, this glory, this important, turning of, we're going into the workers' paradise. And it's all basically, it's just regurgitated workers' paradise verbiage. But they give it to the people, and that is the cover so that they can go about, the idea of depopulation. And what I think is happening is that they have all these different approaches to basically both depopulation and dumbing us down, vaccines, the toxicity in the food. And the point of all the propaganda, the point of like the verbiage from the Club of Rome and the verbiage from the Rockefeller Foundation and, you know, is just so that in our minds we have a rationale that what we're experiencing in terms of like the fact that there's so few of us left is an okay thing. You know, it's actually, you know, it's like that there is really nothing wrong with fewer and fewer people. And of course, ethnicity is, they've been able to maneuver that because that was obviously something that could have resisted them. They've been able to maneuver that into, it's reflecting white supremacy. You know, if you try to question this on the basis of, well, this, you know, our ethnicity, say if you're like a Japanese or a Swedish person and your ethnicity is heading to zero and you complain, well, you're basically trying to, you know, recreate World War II as the Nazis and, the Japanese.
Pathologized ethnic consciousness and also any organization based on ethnicity, because then you're deprive that group of any solid ground to defend their interests.
Yeah. So all of these things, feminism, I mean, it basically, this is the thing. It's a toxic soup, a physically toxic soup, the chemicals, fluorides, the vaccinations, the glyphosate in the food. I mean, it is just a, a toxic lump that makes you stupid and weak and basically unable to have children, I mean, in general. Or if you do, you have autism, right? So you've got the epsilons in the delta class, the neurodiverse.
Well, how does globalism help the environment? Because these extended trade routes or supply chains that they create with globalism, and they undermine local agricultural markets. I was listening to Catherine Austin Fitz talk about how I think 20% of the people in Tennessee are on food stamps, but about a third of the state's farmland lays fallow.
Well, it's completely insane. I mean,
so I'm like, wait a second. Like, what a confused, irrational economy. I mean, it's like
at the control level, they're just laughing at us.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just ludicrous because sort of like the moonshot or something, it's just like these things are just for their amusement, but they're not just for their amusement. They have effective mind control. I have like,
well, that's part of the reorientation of the culture that that gentleman referred to.
Yeah, I mean, they've reoriented
mind
culture
control.
And religious ideas.
Yeah.
And so now we can't think clearly. Our minds, our capacity to think, are as polluted as our bodies.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you get 87% of single women in Ireland to vote for abortion? 87%.
Well, I mean, you do it by, like basically the culture of critique, where you intimidate anyone who would attempt to support or point out the values of family and of large families, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you attack that on the grounds of, well, women are, we're not equal because we're forced to be in the home, we're like slaves. So the culture of critique is effective because they control the media and there is no counter argument to oppose it. All you have left to be able to like help people think clearly is the reality that they're experiencing. It's like in the inner cities in the United States, where you go, gee, how is this welfare state thing working out for you? How did feminism, the welfare state, work out for you here? Let's go inside and get out of the way of the automatic weapon fire so we can have like a peaceful conversation. I mean, the culture is so crushed and so destroyed that it is in and of itself an argument against there. I would think with the Irish population, I don't know. I mean, would it be when their population is reduced by 90%, where and the misery level in women is just through the roof because they're all like single spinsters? I mean, like, where is the point where just the reality of the brave new world is so painful that people recognize that this whole thing was a weaponized agenda that they became confused by? I don't know.
Well, it's pretty clear is when they force they talk about overpopulation, then they force or they promote contraception. And basically, the way you promote abortion and contraception is you promote sexual liberation, sexual freedom, so to speak.
Sure.
But and if you can have that, you're going to have contraception as a backstop, and ultimately abortion, because then you're reminded of what sex is really what it's intended to do. But if you want to be liberated from that reality, you have to have a contraception and abortion. So you, in effect, create the necessity for that just by the changing attitude towards sex. But this ultimately leads to the depopulation. Then all of a sudden, when there's a drop in the native population, they say, well, we need more bodies for labor, so let's have mass migration. So it, obviously, sure. It's not about reducing it; it's about shifting the population for the time being. Ultimately, about reduction, I suppose. But I'm saying they contradict themselves. That's why I was at like the Sierra Club. It came out for like supporting mass immigration. I said, how is that supportive of the environment? It puts more pressure on the environment.
Yeah, I mean, this is the DNA reappearing. I mean, they're always for population reduction of Europeans.
Yeah.
Because they hate them and because they see them as a threat. So as far as like population reduction of that group, yeah, absolutely. But then when it comes time to like fill their their labor camps, well, we'll just bring in all the humans we possibly can, because the integrated world is a politically impotent world. It can't really resist anything. I mean, how can it organize itself?
Yeah, yeah.
How can I mean, you just don't have, I mean, I have never seen an integrated community have any political power that could basically defend itself against the brave new world technocrats.
It's atomized, and there's no public space. There's no sense of community. There's no cohesion or organization. So that,
even European populations, you know, like they say, well, just a white community. It should be like a little tightly knit band of racists. This isn't the case. I mean, the fact is, when they broke apart the ethnic bonds, they really did shatter the capacity to think clearly and resist.
Well, I mean,
the white middle class is so isolated. They sit in their houses. They don't do anything.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at we'll talk obviously the pathology, the tangled pathology that is the black inner city, you know, the ghetto. It's its own wasteland, but in a way, the suburbia became a much more comfortable wasteland, you know. So, you know.
Yeah, you know, I just took a walk on the beach, in Santa Barbara, we have great beaches to walk on, and you get to see, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people, you know, if you take these walks, nice sunset. But it occurred to me that the people were very isolated and atomized. Mm-hmm. You know, there are many people just by themselves kind of wandering, and there were a few couples, but you really had no sense of any kind of community. You just had this miserable isolationism, you know, mm-hmm. that if we were a real kind of ethnicity, it would have been exactly the opposite. There would have been a completely different psychological energy that... because people would have been more basically empathetic with one another, right? This is not to say you cannot have close ties. Please don't, you know, think I'm saying, you know, a German cannot find friendship with an Italian. You know, I'm not pointing.
I understand.
In the broad sense, you can see why they weaponized culture against ethnicity, because the groups that wander around the beaches are isolated. They're atomized. The atomization, like E. Michael Jones talks about this, you know, the creation of the white middle class, man, it was really visible on the beach today. Hundreds of people wandering around, but nobody was close to each other, really. They mm-hmm. didn't. They were just empty spirits kind of drifting along, going nowhere, doing nothing. You need to have ethnic connections as much as you do family connections in order to be a real hurt human.
Well, one would say it's sort of an extension of the family, you know, it's sort of, where you have kin.
And so, I think that, ethnicities can merge. I think that at this point, the populations that are being attacked would do wise. I mean, I think the Swedes and the Germans and I don't know, the Iranians and the Italians, I mean, groups like that should look to merge with one another if what you're producing is a viable kind of ethnic world. I think a world that, and I would define that as being a world that you would recognize your people in your family and those who are related to your family as groups that you would defend and expect to defend you. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
This is kind of the dividing line. I met this young woman on a plane I was going to Europe, and she was sitting there and she was from Ireland. I asked her about Ireland and she said, it's just a grunge pit. She goes, it's just, you know, you can't, I don't, I'm getting out. She said, we're going to live, a group of us are going to be living in like, I forget where it was, maybe Paris. And so what they had done is they were leaving Ireland because of the immigration and because of the, fascist government situation. And they were trying to set up a camp someplace else and just have a little world inside of a foreign city. I think that that's kind of understandable. I didn't criticize her. I was just fascinated by her story. But I think that you need to have a broader picture if you're really going to, you know, have a real full life. I mean, in other words, I think that the world that she was heading to has no chance of really providing her with what she's looking for. Mm-hmm. She said, I'm on a mission. That's what she kept saying. I'm on a mission. And I thought to myself, you know, it's like it's hard in these little, you know, snippet conversations with people you barely know. But I thought, no, she's really mistaken. She's going to find loneliness out there. She's not going to find what she's looking for. What she's looking for is a culture that she belongs to, and which means an ethnicity, which means a family structure. That's what she was really looking for. And so, you know, getting back to the Club of Rome, that's really what they're attacking, Tim. You know, this is really what it's world. They want to reduce population, but but with the idea of having, you know, atomized, isolated individuals, you know, because they always talk about, you know, it isn't just, it isn't numbers, like you said, because if it was, they would, you know, they would try to keep the population static enough to at least keep the population working. You know, in California, when my generation didn't have children, they brought in all the Mexicans. Mm-hmm. But that was the workforce. So that the people who had been convinced they had told about birth control, it wasn't with the idea they were going to reduce population of Los Angeles. You know,
it was replacement.
White in the 50s. What they were going to do was replace the population. Yeah. This had been a weaponized situation. My generation didn't understand it. We were getting stuff like the Club of Rome, thinking, oh, we're just being responsible by having, you know, like at my 30th high school reunion, it was like 800 people in the class. I mean, I don't think there was like 100 children.
Yeah, I think when they start with the psychological warfare, they get the host population, the native population, not to reproduce or recognize that they have to defend a certain territory, and they have, you know, tangible territory and interest to defend. And then once you demoralize them, they don't reproduce enough, and then you can introduce foreigners into the area and replace them, and there's no resistance.
Yeah. And in fact, the idea of resisting is racism. Mm-hmm. So the plan is completely evil. It's genocidal. The people, like in the Club of Rome at the top levels, are just rattlesnakes, but the population hasn't the grammar and the logic skills, because they've been, you know, shattered from all of the education quotes, you know, like they've been going through.
Well, I mean, something like an Alpha, like the Club of Rome, or even the foundations, and now the NGOs and these things, both things, they'll operate sort of surreptitiously. They're meaning that, yeah, you have popular government, you have elections, and we have public debate, and, you know, we have what's talked about in the college classroom, so it's considered acceptable. But behind the scenes, they are reorienting the culture, as they say, reorienting and controlling the public discourse to carry out this revolution without ever having firing a shot. You can do that. And it's being coordinated through these oligarchs that control the media, control the endowments, the universities, the think tanks, and ultimately, you know, what becomes governmental policy. And so it's all being carried out through the top. What's interesting about the Club of Rome and like organizations is it's always started by some well-meaning industrialist or oligarch, you know, right? And they talk about, and superficially they talk about real problems, because regionally there is regional overpopulation, if you will, or there's, you know, underdevelopment in a certain area, which may look like overpopulation because underdevelopment. Africa is a good example of that. It can be kept unstable and poor and ignorant, and whatever problems they're going to have anyway, they can make worse, whatever. But anyway, it addresses things like the pollution issue, whatever that is, because that's multifaceted. But they'll address things like the energy crisis. Well, how is it, you know, that petroleum became such a dominant source of energy in the world? Is it because it's the most efficient source? In many ways, it is, I guess you could say. But if you go through the history of big oil and the Rockefellers, is they worked very hard to suppress alternative energy, particularly, plant-based energy, which particularly diesel was at start plant-based, and they converted it to petroleum-based. The whole notion of oil itself, you know, they call them fossil fuels. Meaning, but the science is never really, you know, we say, oh, it came from dinosaurs. Well, that's It's never been proven. Yeah. You know,
that that is so brilliant. I mean, you made my evening.
I mean, why are we so dependent on these extractive industries? The first place, why are we so dependent on extractive industries, which are heavy capital, very disruptive at the same time? And so much, I'm not saying all of it. I'm not saying it could all be, but a good portion of it, like the Model T could run on ethanol. It could run on Sumac.
They could have had electricity in automobiles, and they did, you know, 7 years ago. But you see, you're right. And that just shows, that just is an absolutely bold red line under the sophistry, under the agenda. You can really see it when you realize that the Rockefellers worked with, you know, the Harrimans and the Rothschild banking groups to basically addict the economies to oil to make money.
People actually drinking,
which of course was the most polluting and overpopulating act that they could, anyone could ever do. Right? You could not do more pollution than the oil industry has laid upon the world in the last 50 years. So this is what they're doing. But at the same time, old John D. Rockefeller developed the Bureau of Social Hygiene, which was trying to create coherent family planning. This was where Weaver's memo comes from, the Bureau of Social Hygiene with John David Rockefeller's support. This is, and of course, he's supporting Margaret Sanger. So you go, well, how can this all make sense? I mean, why would someone who's doing everything he can to pollute and overpopulate the planet find some kind of psychological satisfaction in creating the Bureau of Social Hygiene and fund Margaret Sanger, the American Birth Control League? Well, it only makes sense when you realize that it's the same agenda. You see, it's all designed basically to lead to shattered culture and oligarchic control. That's why these things are being given to us as these terrible.
Good examples. Oil is if a large portion of our everyday energy needs could be derived, say, from plants, where it was originally intended, like with Ford's Model T or diesel, when he developed diesel fuel and he died suddenly, he jumped off a ship on his way to meet the oil barons, and that's when it was converted to petroleum. But they couldn't cartelize it.
Right.
So that's the big thing, is that a lot of this stuff is meant towards policies and prescriptions that eventually it's all about monopolization, cartelization under the guise of, you know, of philanthropy or helping humanity. And this is why it's, you know, everything's being, you know, they'll talk about the problems of the third world and hunger, even like financial problems. Well, wait a second. They run the banks.
Yeah.
Global debt. Well, who issues global debt? I mean, I was talking about, you know, I was talking about, you know, this global debt problem. Well, why don't we tax the bankers? And the profits they get from the interest to pay off the debt.
they create
the debt. I mean, come on.
If John D. Rockefeller is so worried about pollution, all he has to do is shoot himself.
Yes. Yeah.
And the problem solved.
And with fractional reserve banking, debt is a bookkeeping scam.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we did that show. Money is just, it's their dream world that they have led us into, and debt is just, you know, it's like
the, it's okay, we got digital currency, we'll be our savior.
We can't understand we just understand the dollar as something that has wealth, the debt, the electronic world, the trillions, the billions, all this stuff. It just doesn't mean anything to us. That's all some other reality, and they will expand whenever they need all the trillions of dollars for these big projects they created out of thin air. Down here on the ground, we're just told to, you know, give the guy $3 for the McDonald's hamburger that'll make us sick.
For the Impossible Burger at Burger King.
For the Impossible Burger, right? You know, so it's
the Impossible Burger.
So it's
the inedible burger. Like,
yeah, but you know, but the point is, it's just that the same way we believe in the dollar, and that there is, you know, it's as long as you have the belief, the faith, it's like a religion. As long as you have the belief, it works. The dollar is working because we've been told it's real, and, you know, so we're in the matrix. We just believe it's real. It's the same thing here on the other side with the population, is that we've been told that, look, the reason everything is so horrible is because of overpopulation. I mean, the idea that people from the Club of Rome would say, well, you know, we have this really good example of overpopulation and of low resource and like limited resource, World War I and World War II. You see, look, there you have it. This is why we have to like reduce population. I mean, the wars existed because this group created the wars. They were on both sides of the thing. They were shoving us into the into automatic weapon fire, reducing our population in the hundreds of millions. And now in the 70s and 80s, they say, well, there's still too many of you.
Yeah, I mean, in World War II,
the fact that there were wars proves that there's not enough resources to go around.
Yeah,
you know?
In World War II, the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, was fueled by Rockefeller oil, tetraethyl. You know, the aviation fuel.
Sure. I mean, it's just the whole thing is just ridiculous. It's just, you know, like you get into the Club of Rome and it's sort of like LaRouche's trajectories, intellectual trajectories, kind of fun to follow if anyone ever wants to go through the, what do they call them, executive intelligent reports.
Oh, yeah, you
know,
yeah.
That he and his team come out with over again and they start getting into the Club of Rome and they go, ah, but look, this individual is related to this individual. And here's the P2. And look, this whole thing is a gigantic conspiracy. You know, and it's just this rabbit hole that just keeps getting bigger and bigger. But ultimately, I mean, it's very simple. The political class is fake. You know, the banking class are thieves. We are the victims, you see. There's this bifurcation. They're real genius, because I don't think most of the science they create stuff is pretty routine. I think it wouldn't be too difficult for, if we were thinking clearly, to like, we could do all of this without any of them. But what they're great at is just keeping silent. You know, that's what they are good at. That's what the Masons developed, is this. You know, you look at the oath where they take the oath saying if they reveal any secret, they'll get their throat slit.
Yeah, like a Morgan.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then read like the end of, you know, Tom Sawyer, you know, where he talks about the initiation. If anybody says anything, you get killed. I mean, this is what they're good at. So they are able to keep quiet about what they're doing. They have this really powerful Omarta, you know, the silence thing where the lifetime actors get up there and never break out of character. You know, they just stay there the entire time. Think someone like Bush or Clinton, you know, the political class. The training they must have is, you know, it's quite interesting is how it actually works. But they are trained enough to keep the sophistry, you know, to like with a straight face give the explanation as to why we're going to depopulate the countries around Israel, right? It's terrorism, you know, that's there was a 9-1-1, you know, they're just lying their heads off, but they don't break character. And so this is, you know, that is what we're up against, is a group that really has developed secrecy to a high level of efficiency and just of maintaining it.
Yeah, and if you break from it, and a few have, usually it doesn't turn out too well for them. I think there was that banker, German banker in the 80s, Herrhausen, who talked about third world debt relief, writing off some of the debt and starting clean. And he was kidnapped by some communist group and then murdered. And you think Gladio is probably, you know, like the Red Guard or something, was probably fake, cut out like a... and then there was that guy, Mattei, who was the Italian oil minister in the 60s, who was going to get around the Seven Sisters and work out some sort of deal with some of the oil producing countries that was better for them. And his plane blows up, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the one that comes to mind here is the guy who was strung up on the Blackfriar Bridge in London.
Oh, Roberto Calvi. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he actually, you know, he had brought information about P2, which, I mean, P2, that lodge, if it had just been exposed and there had been investigative reporting, the secret society would have been exposed like a beetle in the sunlight. I mean, there, you know, so his death was, you know, and the Masonic manner that it was as executed with is really an important thing for people to understand. You know, they the Silence of the Lamb, that movie, they
was that an official suicide?
Yeah, I believe that's what the official verdict was, that it was suicide.
But he was shoeless and had bricks in his pocket and money.
Yeah, I mean, it was just
because basically he had hundreds of millions went missing at the Banco Ambrosia Bank, and this ties in the mob and the P2 Lodge, of course, and NATO and the use of the Vatican Bank for money laundering to engage in all types of these operations, intelligence operations, even money being funneled to Solidarity. So it gets in all these, basically all the intrigues of the Cold War, international finance, drug trade, organized crime. They all, yeah, you know,
it's all one thing. Yeah. I mean, that's the point, is that you can see with that event that it was when they hanged Roberto Calvi at the Blackfriars Bridge, and it was inside the city of London, you know, in the Square Mile, mm-hmm. that you know, the Masonic heartbeat of the world. It was an example of, you know, what happens when the silence is broken. So, you know, it's an interesting moment in time, Tim, because if you notice this week, YouTube went more draconian in their censorship. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now, YouTube is like just heavy-handed censoring now at this point. I mean, freedom of speech is just out the window. Mm-hmm. But you see, what's happened is the internet was their final mental control over mankind, right? We'd all be sitting there staring at screens that they could control, and they could input any idea that they wanted to. So this was the idea. But along the way, the kind of impossible to control citizens, the irascible ones, they got their hands on it and they started to exchange information. And so now they're trying this draconian stuff where they're going to, you know, censor the heck out of YouTube and everything. They're going to have all kinds of sensors and things on it. But, you know, it's interesting because with someone like Calvi, you know, like in 82, there wasn't enough, you know, because remember I talked about how LaRouche kind of began this idea of the secret society investigation with his research into Club of Rome. As far as I can tell, there wasn't really much that I could find before, but he actually got into it. Well, they could do this to Calvi. They could hang him, right? Okay, problem solved. They got P2 under control. Didn't stop LaRouche or his scholars, but in 82, they thought they could get away with this because they had control over the media.
Yeah.
But now they don't so much. Now, with the internet, you actually can't just hang one guy on Blackfriars Bridge and, you know, carve a, you know, like a skull and bone symbol on him or something. It isn't going to work because there's just too many people. And I don't think that the censorship can really put it back in the bottle, because once you start have like basically millions of people now who are like aware that there is a secret society that uses silence and is genocidal. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that you know, that their ability? I mean, what, see what I'm saying is that the internet is actually this has potential to really create an information revolution that actually would be something that would make the secret society exposed by. So,
yeah, I mean, this is the, I guess, the cunning of reason. That something they created is being used against them, and that perhaps they didn't foresee it, proving that they're not all seeing and all knowing. They made mistakes.
I didn't pick up on this one somehow.
Yeah, and so now it's what they would refer to as a crisis of democracy, meaning that there are too many people talking about it. So they got to shut down YouTube. And one of the problems at this point, to the extent that they control the mainstream media, that's probably a liability because it's pretty much understood, at least by people who are sentient, that it's not a source of reliable information at this point, just a propaganda organ.
And I just think that the sentient beings, I mean, there are that this, you know, there are more and more people who are basically waking up and going, well, wait a second, this doesn't make any sense. I don't think the censoring YouTube is going to make much difference.
No, because YouTube already knows now. Yeah, it's
people. Is that, I mean, like, just like say you or me. I mean, we're, you know, hopefully sentient being people. I don't think it's going to make any difference. I mean, I could care less. Let them censor anything they want. I'm just going to continue to go about my business, my beliefs, and advertise my point of view as much as I can. And already there's alternatives, workarounds to YouTube that are popping up.
Not even Google itself, you know, that runs the show. It's lost all credibility as an information source.
Exactly.
Because of manipulation of the algorithms. So
yeah, and everyone knows this. Yeah. Everyone knows the algorithms are a joke now. And so they're workarounds that are coming everywhere. So I just, you know, when you hear them, they're like talking about this crisis of democracy. I forget who it was who was talking about
it. I think it was Sammy Huntington, maybe.
Yeah, so it's like my, you know, and it's. I read this one piece. I meant to save it or send it to you, but they have all these sensors now. YouTube does that are there just to look at stuff and like pick out the bad thing to get rid of them before it have an influence. But they're having a problem because some of the censors were like being influenced by the YouTube videos that they were looking at. and they didn't know what to do because they were going, well, wait a second, what is this? You know? So you can see the problem they have is that human rationality is not something that they created. This is given to us by other forces, you see.
Yeah.
Birthright. And so they can shape it. And, you know, the culture of critique, I mean, look at how successful they are. But ultimately, we have the capacity and it pops up and causes trouble all the time. And man, I mean, you know, they could take poor Roberto Calvi and hang him in the Masonic Bridge in the city of London in 82. And that was, you know, that was the end of the crisis because all of the newspaper reporters got the message, right? Don't talk about this. That ain't going to happen now. YouTube can hang Roberto Calvi and under, you know, the Google Bridge, but it isn't gonna, no one's gonna pay any attention to this. They, I'm not sure, Tim, but I think that they may have problems here that far beyond what they envision, because there's just too many people waking up. And once they wake up, what are you gonna do? What are you gonna do with them?
Yeah. And so now when an outfit like the Club of Rome comes up with a pronouncement about something, and I mean, I think there's a collective rolling of the eyes and say, oh, yeah.
Yeah. So the thing is, I think we can expect, you know, draconian blocking of these topics on like newspapers, YouTube, algorithm working against us. Obviously, the mainstream media will just be, you know, Sandy Stahl, you know, talking to, you know, Hillary Clinton about, you know, women's rights and things like this. But I just.
Well, again, we talk about depopulation and abortion, but if you Google abortion, suppose on Google now, I mean, the first like four or five pages are like references to Planned Parenthood and,
well,
you know, whereas if the algorithms were working properly, I mean, you'd get probably the searches would be, you know, pictures of aborted babies, but that's not good optics. So Google has manipulated the algorithm, the searches, to change perception or reorient the public to support a particular agenda, which is abortion, you know.
But the problem is, Tim, that every single person that is sentient is aware of this.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? There are no exceptions. If you're a sentient being and you, you know, type in like abortion and you get like five pages of propaganda, it doesn't even matter if you're an abortion proponent. You're going to know it's BS. It's the propaganda doesn't work if you're aware it's propaganda. So, I mean,
what happened like in the Eastern Bloc in the Soviet Union in the 70s and 80s, where everyone knew, even party apparatchiks knew it was all BS.
Yeah.
No one believes in the system anymore. Yeah.
So the Club of Rome, they can just say anything they want. No one is going to believe them from going forward. There is like, mentally and morally debased as the IMF or, any of the Rockefeller Foundation groups. I mean, that no one pays. I mean, it's just, there are people who will attend the meetings. There are newspapers that will.
Well, because there's money.
There's money involved.
Yeah, you can always pay people to show up. Yeah, yeah.
The Club of Rome is just a bad algorithm on Google. It isn't not gonna fool anybody, man.
So, okay, Joe.
All right, Tim.
Take it easy.
Bye bye. Bye bye. Thank you. We'll be right back.